Time now to go to Sunday school with the professor.
Hey, Professor, take it easy, will you?
Giants third base coach Ron Wotus with Marty Lauren.
I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper.
On your home of Giants baseball.
Good answer. Like the way you think.
KNBR 104.5 and 680, the sports leader.
Brought to you by River Islands, one of the country's top-selling master-planned communities just across the Altamont in Lathrop. Where else can you live on a lake, next door to a park, or walking distance to your kid's new school? With 10 new neighborhoods, River Islands is the one place you can't afford to miss.
And we welcome the third base coach of the Giants, and that is the Professor Ron Wotus. Well, how are you?
Good evening, Marty. I'm doing great.
Very good. You know, it's funny. We get our River Island spot early, and it made me think about what I talked about today, and that is, of course, maintaining our social distance. This thing is not going to go away by itself, and we're making a dent in it, and we're doing it by masks and social distance and being very cognizant of where everyone else is. And I thought of River Islands with all the trails and all the exercise and stuff like that. It's a good commercial for River Islands just for that alone.
Yeah, that's a good point, Marty. You know, there's so much extra space out there, as you're saying, with the trails, because, you know, that's one thing that I'm fortunate, with this shutdown and lockdown, is that I have a home and I have a big yard and I can get outside or do my thing. And it certainly is nice to be able to walk, whether it's your streets or your neighborhood, but out there in River Islands, they have a beautiful scenery, the walking trails, the river. It's nice to have, because we can't go to our state parks. Everything's shut down. You know, you have to stay away and stay from each other. So I think that's a real good point on that matter right off the top.
Yeah, I'm glad. I mean, as we're listening to it, I said, boy, that is a real advantage of it. Well, you have the big yard, and there was a little video on the Internet this week of Joe Kelly. Remember Joe Kelly, the pitcher for the Dodgers, the right-hander?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, he was. He has this little screen set up in his backyard, and he pitches to the screen. Something like we had when we were kids, the ball bounces right back to you, that kind of thing. And there he was, and he was throwing his changeup. He missed the screen by 3 feet and threw it through his bedroom window. Did you see that? Come on.
That's great. You know, you don't expect it from a major leaguer, but we all did that as kids growing up, right? Whether we were hitting the golf ball through a window or playing catch or the football, we were always getting in trouble breaking something outside. And when we had to play inside, the game stopped when you knocked over a lamp, right? So that's fun to see a major leaguer do that. And I guess he put it on his Instagram, did he?
Yeah, and he looked surprised. Like, how did that happen? Meanwhile, let's talk about Joe Kelly just for a second. Yeah, we know him. He was very good for the Red Sox in the World Series with the Dodgers. Not quite as good, but boy, the guy throws hard, and he's got a breaking ball. It's just for him to be consistent, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he came over to the Dodgers to get that big contract, I think 3 years. And, you know, they really didn't feel like he's lived up to it. But he did pitch extremely well for him, I think, the second half of the season. And me personally, when he comes into the game, I don't like to see it. He's got great movement on his fastball, and he's got a real good breaking ball. And, I didn't see him over there in the American League, but he certainly has the stuff to dominate. And when he's on, he's one of the tougher pitchers in the league to hit. So maybe he'll continue to break windows when the season starts. That'd be good for us.
Yeah, it would be. And he pitched did he pitch against the Giants with the Cardinals? I'd have to look it up. But remember, he was with the Cardinals, wasn't he? And then he went to Boston from there, I think.
Boston. Yeah, he was very young, I believe, with the Cardinals when he started. And, I didn't really start to follow him that much until he went to Boston, because my nephew, Connor, he looks just like him. So when my nephew comes visits me, he lives in Connecticut, and he follows the Red Sox. And everybody says he's Joe Kelly. He's out at a restaurant or something. People come up and ask him for his autograph. So I started following this guy. But he's a talented pitcher, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Very good. Hey, before Bill joins us, today is an anniversary of the first game in the old Yankee Stadium. This is the one with the facade and that we've talked about, where Bill Fisher gave up the long home run, the mantle, and all that stuff. Did you ever go to the old Yankee Stadium?
Yes, absolutely. And what a special place. I mean, I grew up in New England, as you know, and of course I was a Red Sox fan growing up, so I wasn't real fond of the Yankees. But when you went to that ballpark with all the history and all the great players that have come through there, you know, and you walk out to center field and see the monuments, et cetera, it's a special place. And I enjoyed my trips in there. And you hate to see those parks go. You know, you really do. And then, you know, time trounces forward, and, you know, now all the old parks are gone except for Fenway Park and certainly Wrigley. And, you know, sometimes when those parks are gone, we kind of get used to the new facility. They got the great weight rooms. They have, you know, the facilities inside are great for your working environment. You know, the training rooms, you're not cramped, the locker rooms. But still, deep down, it's sad to see those old parks go.
You know, I went to Fenway once. Let's see, Red Sox played Cleveland, and I'm trying to think. I think Carlos Baerga was playing like third base, or Jim Thome was a third baseman in those days. I mean, it was early, it was the mid-90s. And I remember going to Fenway, and I bought a ticket, and of course I was right behind a pole. And that was it. You know, you got stuck behind a pole. That's just the way it goes.
That's bad. That's buzzard luck, Marty, you got there. Everybody else, they love it. But they do have a few seats that aren't that good. But it's special going to those places. You know, it brings you back to your childhood. It did me. You know, we'd go to Fenway Park when I was a kid once a year. That was our trip to a major league game, you know, growing up in Connecticut. And it was just once a year. That was it. And I loved the Red Sox, and I loved baseball. And that's where it all started.
Yeah, we all have that moment. Someone brought it up the other day to me about the ballparks today. Of course, kids grow up today, everything's in color. You know, it's color, you know, on the internet, or, you know, and for us going to a ballpark, and Bill, I'm sure, had the same experience the first time going, you know, it's just so green to just see, you never forget it. We've chatted about that. But I think even in a world of color, seeing a ballpark for the first time and seeing how it all fits together with the foul lines and, you know, the bases and this and that and the wall and the outfield, there's still something about seeing a ballpark live, forgetting about the black and white and the color for a second.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, we're getting nostalgic now here. You know, you're thinking about, you know, years ago, and you know, I was certainly my first year in a major league ballpark. I'd never seen anything like that. You know, the players were larger than life, and you're watching them on TV, right? You're watching them on the game of the week, and once in a while you'd catch a game on TV, the local games you would see, and with the local channel playing, with the Red Sox playing. But when you go there, it is special. It is special. You know, there's a lot of people that grow up close to the parks. You hear the story. I think even you were close to a park somewhere. I remember you telling some stories about that, and that's special to be able to do that, because for myself it was a big treat to go to a major league ballpark.
Yeah, I took the trolley down Church Avenue to Rogers Avenue, and then somehow got to Bedford Avenue, and next thing I knew I was at Ebbets Field. And
wow,
you know,
wow.
8 or 9 years old, you could do it then alone. You know, today you can't do that, but that's what we did.
Exactly.
Hey, let's bring in Bill Lasky. Bill, how are you?
Good evening. I'm doing good, Marty. How are you guys doing? I'm listening to your stories as you break the show open. And I just want to go back to Joe Kelly real quick. How can he be working on a changeup with a pitchback? That one thing that just blew me away. His arm location was really bad. And sure enough, he misses the pitchback, Ron, and he literally launches it into the, looks like a bedroom window, and shatters it. It was hilarious when I first saw it. I was just like, what is this guy doing? But,
yeah,
those are the things. I'm sure there's a lot of players trying to do to get in shape, from throwing balls against the garage door to getting infield plays. But what are some of the players doing, Ron, with themselves to stay in shape?
Yeah, well, you know, the coaches, we all send stuff out, you know, programs, the, you know, conditioning programs, just not with the weights, but drills. Kai sent out drills. Antoine sent out drills to the outfielders, things that they can, you know, do on their own to try to simulate, you know, when we do get back into spring training, that that they're ready to go. It's more than just being in, you know, a condition running and, mm-hmm. and lifting weights, but, you know, the quick starts, can you, you know, move quickly without pulling muscles? So, well, there's a lot of drills that you can do, but it's hard right now. Look, let's be honest. It's extremely hard. I mean, I think if you got to be creative, just like Wilmer Flores has. He's got his grandmother flipping him soft toss. I don't know if you saw that on Facebook or Twitter. He had his grandmother flipping him soft toss, and he was taking swings. And it's hard to find somebody to work out with, right, because of the social distancing and, you know, pitchers mm-hmm. throwing off mounds. I think I heard one pitcher in the big leagues got fined. He was at a park, and someone fined him. The park's closed. He's not supposed to be out there. And so there's no place for these guys to try to simulate some things and try to get ready for the spring.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great. It's great to be innovative. A-Rod had something on Twitter today where he had like the rubber ball, the Spalding, you know, the pink ball that we had as, at least I did as a kid, you know, for stick ball. And he was mm-hmm. about 3 feet from a wall and he just kept flipping the ball to the wall, you know, and it's just the quick movement of trying to catch it and mm-hmm. trying to do that. It made me think about, I don't know, well, you played wiffle ball, right? Bill, what did you play as a kid?
I played wiffle ball and stick ball. You know, the
you
real
did play stick ball. How'd you play stick ball? Yeah, how'd you do
the
that?
The broomstick handle and then a tennis ball and then literally pitching off a flat ground. And you literally had a catcher sitting back there with no gear on trying to catch this tennis ball that you were probably trying to throw 100 miles an hour. We did that in the backyard of parking lots behind supermarkets. And also wiffle ball was always fun when you had your family and friends around.
But, you know, I'll tell you one thing that I learned, and then we'll go on to regular baseball. One of the games we played in Miami Beach was called half ball. And you took a tennis ball and you cut it in half. And you threw it, and you had to throw it sort of almost like sidearm. So it came in mm-hmm. like a frisbee. And that's the way we would play. That was tough. That was tough to hit. Let me tell you, try to hit a tennis ball in half.
Those are called bad sliders.
Well, you know what, that wiffle ball that had the holes on it, one side was solid, the other half has the holes. You can make that thing move like a tennis ball, a half tennis ball. You can make it break right and left. And that was fun, you know, playing wiffle ball because you could do so much with the baseball. You couldn't do it with a real baseball as a kid. But I'll leave you with this. I think one thing that my brother and I did is against the steps coming into the house, you know,
absolutely.
Made a little concrete there, and we would bounce the ball off there. And if the ball got to the grass and we didn't field it cleanly, you'd have an error, and we'd throw it as hard as we could at each other, and we spent hours just trying to catch that ball. And that's a great drill for an infielder, and kids out there should be doing it now if they want to keep busy. I mean, and it's fun. I mean, but it doesn't have to be a baseball. It could be a tennis ball. Actually, a spongier mm-hmm. ball is harder to play with, as you guys have mentioned.
No, yep. Come on, that was called stoop ball. Yeah, in Brooklyn? Come on, in Brooklyn, we played stoop ball. You throw it against the steps, and if you could get it at the point of the step, you know, it was like then it would be a line drive coming back at you.
And, right.
Oh, well, let me tell you, we played a lot of stoop ball.
Yep. I'm sure Bill did the same, and so did I. We didn't have that everything organized, and you know, it's a little different today. There's other activities, but you know, you give us a ball of any sort, give a guy a ball when we were growing up, and you'd stay busy with that thing for a while.
Yeah, very good.
The only other thing I was going to throw in there, you always did the old strike zone against a wall, and you always played strikeout that way. You know, with the box on the wall, and you just ended up playing fast pitch against that. Those are basic ways of playing, you know, one on one or two on two games, but we used to do that all the time.
See, I'll tell you the problem with the wall, and we did this in Brooklyn. We did it all the time. If you found somebody, remember that Tom Gordon, he threw the drop? You know, he threw that big mm-hmm. curveball? Well, when you had the box on the wall, the ball would go past your head, and it would drop into the box. And that was trouble. And Tom Gordon, I swear to you, I talked to Tom Gordon 20 years ago, and he grew up in Florida, and I said, what's the pitch that you throw? And he called it a drop. That's the first time I had heard that in a long time. Tom Gordon, good pitcher, wasn't he?
Very good.
Yeah, right-hander. All right, let's talk Tim Lincecum. We had a full day of Lincecum today. Well, start it off. You touched on Lincecum a little bit last week, but the no-hitters and, you know, being on the bench for the no-hitters, and this is a kid who doesn't observe baseball tradition. What was it like on the no-hitters with Lincecum?
Well, everything about this guy is different than the norm, really, you think of a major league pitcher. And, you know, just his nickname, the Freak, when I first saw Timmy first in spring training playing catch, you know, his stature, he was so small, he wasn't that heavy. And then you watch him play catch, and the ball would come out of his hand like he was a superhero. I mean, the thing, he'd go nice and easy, and that thing would explode, and that's what made him so special. You know, he had that great velocity. His delivery in those no-hitters, obviously, you know, everybody had a difficult time picking up the ball on Tim Lincecum, especially early in his career, and he threw so hard, and then he threw such great off-speed pitches. He had a big curveball. I mean, he had weapons, and in those no-hitters, boy, he just made it look easy. I think there was only a couple plays in his first no-hitter. I think Pablo made a play on a ground ball down the line at third base in San Diego in the seventh inning, and he made a great play on it. And, of course, Hunter Pence saved him in the eighth inning with two outs on a line drive, I think, by the shortstop Cabrera, if I'm not mistaken, that he made a diving catch coming in. But besides that, they didn't square up all that many balls, and he really made it look easy in that no-hitter.
You know, one of the biggest things that comes to fashion with the first one, which was in 2013, was right before the All-Star break. Of course, we go right to 148 pitches. Nobody goes out there anymore with 148 pitches. I think it was something recently that somebody said to Bruce Bochy, did you know he went out for 148 pitches? And, of course, Bruce, which is his one-liner, said, well, I don't think he would have done that today's game. Of course, you wouldn't, because everything's on pitch count, not even over 100. But that game right there, 148 pitches, and I looked at his line, 96 strikes. But he struggled in that game. He was up and down. I'm going to look at how many walks. Four walks, 13
four.
Ks. Yeah, 13 Ks. It was pretty high, but I thought that was one of the first things that really surprised me. He kept going out there. He kept going out there because I remember watching the game, and he was dead tired at the end, no doubt. But to keep him out there for 148 pitches, well, he had the All-Star break after, and he had extra rest. But that was one thing that really, really surprised me watching that game. And then the finish line. He threw the ball real well, and, of course, at San Diego at Petco, which is a tough park to pitch in.
So what are you guys talking about on the bench, well, with Bochy? I mean, as Bill outlines it, 148, it could have gone to 160. What were you going to do?
Yeah, well, look, it's, you know, that's the beauty of, you know, of being a baseball man. I mean, how are you going to take this guy out of the game with a no-hitter? I mean, really, Timmy, at that point in time, I think he had a 4.6 ERA. We had an 8-0 lead. And, you know, getting a no-hitter is one of the most difficult things to do in sports. And, you know, the pitch count is the pitch count. But Bill just mentioned it. We had extra time at the All-Star break. And, you know, Boach and Rags are going to give this guy every opportunity to get this no-hitter. And to your point, it was a little unnerving because he was throwing balls. You know, we wanted him to get it over with earlier, and thank goodness it was only 148, because I truly believe if it's a 160, he would have thrown 160 to get that no-hitter.
he turned out to be – he got a couple of hits in the second no-hitter. Well, what kind of a hitter was he? Could he bunt, and could he get hits? Well, what did you deal with when Lincecum got to the plate?
Yeah, I'd say he was average. You know, I consider him an average hitter. He put the ball in play out over the plate, you know, maybe slightly below average. He wasn't a bad bunter. You know, nothing special, nothing like Bumgarner and Vogelsong and a few of these guys that can really hit. But, you know, he did all right. We didn't care how he hit, though, Marty. I mean, this guy was so dominant when he was on. And the thing that's shocking to me is he had two no-hitters. But if you look at his career, for as good as he was, he only lasted 8 or 9 years in the big leagues. And, you know, a lot of scouts, when he was drafted, they say, well, his stature and his size and the unorthodox delivery, they didn't think he was going to last. And, you know, I tell you what, to have a couple no-hitters in a World Series and watch him dominate the way he did, only playing 8 years of Major League Baseball, I still think it was a great job by our organization to draft this guy number one.
You know, Ron and Marty, you know, one of the biggest things that I used to always ask him, and I asked his dad also, is he never used ice after the game. Most of the time, pitchers put ice on their shoulder. They dip their elbow in ice water to get the inflammation down from the many pitches and takes the swelling out of the arm. I did it religiously. I did it even after I threw on a side just to put ice on. And I think more mental than physical when it gets down to it, because you iced for 20, 22 minutes and you felt better after. But this guy never iced. He didn't put, he came in, he took a new t-shirt, put his new t-shirt on, he was fine. And he said if the ice would stiffen him up, and I never heard that. And I asked his dad and Tim that, and he never put ice on it through high school, college. And he said, I just didn't want to do it. And I always wondered if that took a toll on his arm as he got into latter part of his career, because I just felt that maybe that took some wear and tear out of his arm.
You know, he was so good in 12 in the World Series and the playoffs. You know, we've gone through those games of multiple innings that he threw. Well, Bill, I always thought he could come out of the bullpen and give you an inning or give you something. Did he just not want to be a bullpen guy and he wanted to be a starter?
Well, I think everybody wants to be a starter. I think that's how you come out of college, come out of high school, you're the starting pitcher. You never really want to be a reliever. Back in our days, you didn't want to go to the bullpen. You wanted to start because you wanted to try to close the game, finish the game. That's what the mentality of a starter was. And I think that's how he was out of – I think he went to University of Washington. And he dominated up there. And he just proceeded to come right in. The only time I remember him relieving was in the playoffs and World Series. That was about the only time, and we talked about that last week. He was dominant coming out of the bullpen.
Well, you see him as a reliever?
Yeah, well, you're right. We had those discussions. Look, he was so dominant, you know, early on, but when he, you know, his ERA was around 5 and he wasn't getting it done as a starter, you know, he lost a little velocity. I think one of his biggest assets is, as you know, hitters didn't pick up the ball good. He had such a, you know, his movement on his fastball. He could ride that fastball up. The split change thing, he had a big curveball, and he was effectively wild. We talked about it in the no-hitter. Bill just pointed out how he struggled, but it's hard to square him up. And we had multiple conversations. I don't remember the year, but we needed a closer. And a lot of us, you know, were in favor of making Timmy the closer, because your point, Marty, you know, one time through the lineup with the pitches he had, and just never came to fruition. Of course, he pitched out of the bullpen later on in his career, not as a closer, but I believe he could have been an outstanding closer, because he was real durable too. And he, you know, everything this guy did was unorthodox. And he'd warm up for a game. The game would be at 7:15. He'd go out there at 7:05. He'd throw 20 balls and he'd go into the game. And he's one of those freaks that you go, well, you know, isn't he preparing? Isn't he stretching? No, everything about him was different. Just not how he prepared for the game. But, you know, he didn't seem like a guy that was that competitive in the clubhouse, a happy-go-lucky kid. But when he was on the mound, he was all business, and that's when he would find focus and get it done. So, I mean, I could go on and on about things that made him so unorthodox, but that's what made him the freak and such a special guy in Giants history.
Yeah, very, very, very special. Very special.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to say the dominance of that curveball when he started flipping that curveball in. And the slider, too. He had a little slider toward the end. A lot of those, just like Marty was saying about Gordon, a lot of those pitches were strikes. And then when they swung over him, they were outside the strike zone. That's what made that changeup so dominant in the curveball, because they were so late break, so lasting with the curveball, was so tight. And that's one of the reasons I think Sanchez caught him a little bit more, because he threw a lot of balls in the dirt. And with the second no-hitter Sanchez caught, I thought Sanchez was awesome that game. He was one of the better receivers as a backup catcher the Giants had, especially behind Posey.
Yeah, you're right,
Sanchez,
Billy did a great job in that game.
Yeah, he was the magnet,
Marty?
Sanchez was the magnet to get hit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't know if he was going to make every game. He'd get a foul tip, and he'd go down, and he'd be, you know, gasping for air, and then, you know, trainers would be looking at us. They wouldn't want to go out on the field because it was like every start he would get banged somewhere, and we're thinking, is this guy going to die in the field, or is he going to get through the game? He definitely did take his lumps out there.
It was something. All right, we're going to take a break. I promised Raph we'd try to take a break or two in our segments. But what I want to talk about next, and Jason Stark wrote a great column about it in The Athletic this week, really good. And, well, you probably remember this, the Benji Molina home run that wasn't. And with Emmanuel Burris pinch running and all this stuff, it's a tremendous story. So I want to chat about that. As I said, in The Athletic, Jason Stark this week wrote a really good column about it. So we'll talk to Bill and Wo right after this, right after these messages.
Talking baseball with Marty Lurie on KNBR 104.5 and 680 The